Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Psych Legal Pop Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about popular culture through the lens of an attorney and a therapist. I'm Brooke Brigham, I'm the attorney.
And I'm Tess Brigham, I'm the therapist.
And on today's show, we are going to discuss the Scott Peterson case from a new angle. First, I just wanted to make a very quick announcement. If you haven't heard already, we now have a Patreon. And so if you like our content and you want more, please go to patreon.com/psychlegalpop or just search psychlegalpop in Patreon and you can see what we have to offer there. And just want to make that announcement before we get started. And also the Scott Peterson case is a complex one. It evokes a lot of emotions in people. And we're not really here to, rehash the entire case. We're here because there's been some recent developments in the case, very, very significant legal developments. And so we're first going to do a synopsis of the case. Then we're going to talk about what has happened since Scott Peterson was convicted. There have been a couple different things, a very recent thing involving new evidence, and then maybe get into, a little bit more about what this all means. So that's what we're going to be doing today. So Tess, start us off. Tell us just in a nutshell.
I'm looking at my quote unquote synopsis. and if you can believe that I've cut a lot down, so I'm going to try to do the best that I can with this. But so more than 20 years have passed since the murder of Lacey Peterson and her unborn child, a case that garnered national attention after she initially went missing in December of 2002. So her husband, Scott Peterson, was convicted of two counts of murder in 2004 in a controversial decision that was later upheld by the Supreme Court of California. Peterson's death sentence was commuted to life in prison after several appeals, but he has remained behind bars despite questions about the circumstantial evidence presented by the prosecution during the trial. 20 years after the original sentencing, however, the Innocence Project, an organization that seeks to exonerate wrongful convictions, has picked up Peterson's case, saying new evidence has surfaced that supports Peterson's claims of innocence. So in March of 2024, Peterson was granted a status hearing in response to a request by LA Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal advocacy organization which stated that it had new evidence to support Peterson's claims of innocence. So Lacey Peterson was 8 months pregnant when she went missing on December 24th, 2002 from their home in Modesto, California. The remains of her and her unborn son were discovered in April 2003 on the shores of the San Francisco Bay. And subsequently, Scott was arrested and charged with two counts of murder. In November of 2004, he was found guilty of the first degree murder of Lacey and the second degree murder of the infant. The broad strokes are that Scott told police that he last saw his wife at 9:30 in the morning on December 24th when he left to go fishing at the Berkeley Marina. He said that Lacey was at home watching an episode of Martha Stewart about meringue and preparing to do some things around the house. There were sightings of their dog, Mackenzie, out roaming around by herself by three different neighbors, two of which said that they did return the dog back to their backyard, to the Petersons' backyard. One said that she was on a leash. So Scott returned home that afternoon and found Lacey's car in the driveway, the house empty. He showered and washed his clothes, and then he started walking around the neighborhood asking neighbors where he was. He told people that he had been golfing that day. And then finally, they reported her missing at 6 p.m. that evening. And and they found out, they went and they interviewed Lacey's parents and Scott. And Scott told them that he had been fishing at the Berkeley Marina, which is about 90 miles from the couple's Modesto home. So on January 17th, 2003, it became known that Scott had engaged in two other extramarital affairs prior to his affair with a woman named Amber Fry. Fry informed police of the relationship on December 30th, 2002, shortly after discovering he was a person of interest in Lacey's disappearance. She told detectives that she met Scott on November 20th and that he had initially told her he was single. She also informed police that on December 9th, 2 weeks before Lacey's disappearance, Scott had told her that he was a widower and it would be the first Christmas without his wife. Fry agreed to phone him while the police recorded her phone conversations with Scott in the hopes of getting him to confess. So again, like I mentioned, April 13th, 2003, the mutilated body of a full-term fetus was found on the shoreline of the San Francisco Bay by a couple walking their dog. The following day, the badly decomposing body of a woman was found a few miles north of the Berkeley Marina, where Scott had told investigators he had been fishing the day of Lacey's disappearance. On April 18th, 2003, DNA testing confirmed the identity of Lacey and the baby. Scott Peterson was then arrested. He was found in La Jolla, California. His dark hair dyed blonde and his car filled with $15,000 in cash, four cell phones, two driver's license, several changes of clothes, and survival camping gear. Because he was near the Mexico border, prosecutors accused him of planning to flee the country. On April 21st, 2003, Scott pleaded not guilty on counts of capital murder during an arraignment. The trial was then moved to San Mateo County in June 1st, 2004, when the trial began. The trial lasted 5 months and called for more than 180 witnesses. There were many issues having to do with the jurors during deliberation. One juror was replaced with an alternate juror. The jury foreman was also removed at his request after allegedly clashing with other jurors. Scott Peterson was found guilty of first-degree murder and second-degree murder. First-degree murder of Lacey, second-degree murder of Connor on November 12th of the same year. December 13th, he was sentenced to death. On July 5th, 2012, and November 24th, 2015, these are two different appeals that were filed. Both were turned down. On August 24th, 2020, Peterson's death sentence was overturned. And then on December 8th, 2021, he was resentenced to life without the possibility of parole in prison. And then December 20th, 2022, Peterson denied a new trial. And then in January 18th, 2024, that's when the LA Innocence Projects picks up the case. And the Innocence Projects, basically, they are saying that that there's new evidence that has surfaced proving that Scott's innocence and argued his constitutional rights were violated during the original proceedings. So as you can see, these were just the broad strokes. These were a very complex case where a lot of things happened. And I think that what got us interested was, you know, this is one of those cases where people don't really, there've been various, documentaries and such that have come out, but it's one of those cases that people don't debate that much. It's not a debated case. And so I was very surprised when the LA Innocence Project took on his case. And that's why I was very curious to hear, like, what is this new evidence? I would, you know, why, what is it that's so compelling for the Innocence Project, who, which I would think they have limited funds and time and energy. So for them to take on this case, I would think this is a pretty big deal, right?
Yeah. I mean, the synopsis you just read is kind of like the official synopsis that the public has been using, you know, for the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a case where you have a defendant who's extremely vilified because he's accused of murdering his wife and unborn child. And that accusation right there really colored anything that came after it. And I mm-hmm. don't think he ever had a fair chance at a fair trial, no yeah. matter what. And we'll get more into this in a minute. But, you know, the police ignored evidence that didn't fit their narrative. Their narrative was that he killed them. They ignored evidence from other sources. They didn't have certain things tested. They didn't listen to people who were trying to point them in a different direction. They just completely shut that down. And so it's only now, all these years later, that you have, you know, this advocacy group who are pushing this and pushing this, you know, the release of this other information and DNA testing and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it's been very, very, very biased. And so we wanted to kind of step back and take a look at this, you know, more holistically, because the reality is, this is a 100% circumstantial evidence case. Mm-hmm. You know, there's literally nothing tying the police literally have no idea how this woman died, mm-hmm. when she died, where she died, how it happened. They have nothing. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, her dead body ended up in the Berkeley Marina, but there's other reasons why that could have happened, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
But just to back up a little bit, one thing that's interesting about this case is that the reason why the death penalty was overturned in 2020 was because the California Supreme Court unanimously ruled that he'd been unconstitutionally sentenced to death. And this had to do with a big blunder of the trial judge. So if you're going to sit on a jury that's where it's a death penalty case, you have to be with, it's called death qualified. So even if you are opposed to the death penalty, that doesn't automatically disqualify you. The judge then has to further question you mm-hmm. whether, despite your beliefs, you know, if you sit on this jury and you hear evidence that would lead you to believe that this person committed these murders, could you follow the law mm-hmm. and sentence them to death despite your own personal beliefs? And the judge didn't do that in a lot mm-hmm. of situations. What he did was he just did one of those, you know, the juries, especially in a big case like this, they have to do these big, long questionnaires. They ask them all kinds of things before they start questioning them in person. And one of the questions was, you know, do you believe in the death penalty? And anybody who said no, he automatically disqualified. Mm-hmm. So so that's what led to the overturning of the death sentence, just to clear that up. But I don't know where you want to start. Well, let's start with how we got to where we are now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there have been people, especially his family, who have been fighting for years to try to get somebody to take an unbiased look at this case. Mm-hmm. And when the Innocence Project, the Los Angeles Innocence Project, was contacted, now the Los Angeles Innocence Project is different from the Innocence Project that everyone thinks of, you know, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, you know, from the OJ case. Mm-hmm. But it's a part of a network of, there's like 72 different innocence projects across the country in different states and whatnot. So they're somewhat affiliated, but it's not the same thing. So what they are seeking is evidence of, Well, let me back up a little bit. So around the time, I can't remember what, let's see. So I don't know what day it was. Sorry, but about a mile away, I think this was after Lacey disappeared, about a mile away from their house, there was a burned out van, a torched van that was linked to a robbery that was across the street from the Petersons' house. The van plus some purported sightings of Lacey Peterson before her disappearance and traces after it weren't properly presented at the trial. The Innocence Project is asking that the DNA testing be done on the blood found inside the van and that previously unheard interviews with witnesses who cast doubt on the guilt of Scott Peterson be examined by the court. So there were DNA samples taken from this van, and they obviously had DNA samples from Lacey. They never cross-matched the two.
Mm. Wow.
If there was a match.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, they were, the police had tips from other people that I think they apprehended some of the people involved in this robbery. And they gave conflicting statements about, you know, whether or not Lacey Peterson may have witnessed this robbery and whether they abducted her because she was a witness and whether one of these robbers may have killed her because she was a witness. It was a pretty elaborate robbery. They were taking a safe out of the home.
Wow.
You know, they were found, there was a safe. So, I mean, it was, I guess, some sort of high stakes robbery.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's what they're trying to seek is this, they want this evidence so they can do DNA testing. They want to know who the police spoke to about this. They want to know what these people said about it. They really believe that, you know, this is their theory, was that she happened upon this robbery across the street. She confronted these people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was bringing attention to what was going on, and they may have kidnapped her just to get her to shut up. The dog obviously was let loose because it was wandering around. She was out mm-hmm. walking the dog, and the dog was walking loose on the streets, and a neighbor found the dog and took the dog back to the house, put the dog in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's the gist of, you know, the evidence that they're seeking.
Yeah.
Oh, this is another thing, was that this evidence was turned over to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice must have done some kind of report on it, but somehow, you know, the defense never got any reports on what the Department of Justice found in this van and the robbery and all the evidence that was connected to the van. And the van was found on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
This all happened on Christmas, you know,
the
Christmas Day. And it was abandoned like a mile away from their house on this dirt road in what's called the airport district. And so that's the crux of what they're looking at.
So this DNA still exists. It exists in the system, right? It hasn't been thrown away or destroyed.
Right. Okay. No, it's in the system because they took DNA samples from the van.
Okay. Got it.
So there was like a mattress in the back of the van that had blood on it. And there was testing of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it just kind of went off to some place.
Yeah.
Somewhere. And it's in, you know, in some computer somewhere. Mm-hmm.
So it's very egregious, right, that to hear that the police, you have a missing person and there's a burglary in the same neighborhood and you find a van with blood on a mattress, right, and you don't ask yourself the question of like, maybe this could be the same person, right?
Yeah.
And this is before they even really, I mean, that's the other thing about Scott Peterson, right? Like, this is the next day.
Yeah.
So they had already, because I had read, when I was doing my synopsis, I had read something where immediately the two detectives were talking about how Scott was, you know, they didn't like his demeanor, and mm-hmm. they thought he was arrogant, and they thought he was all of these things. And I bet you he is. You know, I'm not, again, it's that projection that we have of, this isn't how I would act if my wife went missing. So therefore, if you're acting differently, then that's bad or wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is like, these police detectives, they always go back to these old narratives, like, you know, the husband did it.
Yeah.
You know, and okay, that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Because a lot of times they do.
Yeah. Statistically, probably you're right. But you still have a duty to, if there's other information out there, you have a duty to investigate that and say, okay, I've investigated this. I'm eliminating this as a possibility.
Yes.
You have to look at other possibilities and, you know, decide if that's a realistic connection or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And the Innocence Project is saying that, you know, they've gone through all the information, you know, from the trial, from the investigation, and, they're seeking the identity of numerous citizens, potential material witnesses, and possible suspects, as well as sensitive investigative leads related to Mr. Peterson's claim of innocence, information that was referenced throughout various police reports, tip sheets, other investigative materials from the prosecution and the defense. So these lawyers from the Innocence Project have gone through everything and they've pinpointed things. It's very precise. They're like, well, what about this? There's this mention of this witness. There's this mention of this, yet, you know, that was never part of the investigation, the official investigation, certainly never, a lot of the stuff, it sounds like, was never even turned over. You know, there was reference to this information, but it was never turned over to the defense.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, there were the suspects, the burglary suspects, denied having anything to do with the break-in, but suggested to police that maybe the burglars were confronted by Lacey Peterson and they did something stupid. This witness further claimed to have knowledge that someone other than Mr. Peterson killed Lacey because he stated that he knows Mr. Peterson is innocent. You know, so these robbers were saying different things that, you know, they didn't want to come out and say it, but, again, none of this was given to the defense.
Got it.
So,
and then are they also going to address, or maybe you have a list there, but so it's the evidence that they didn't get, the not testing the DNA, and is it also the jury? Because I remember from that there was a A&E documentary that was produced by the people that cooperated were obviously, it was very pro Scott Peterson. I will say that because Mark Garagos, his attorney, who has always maintained his innocence, was interviewed and he was a part of it. But I remember the jury stuff being really surprising to hear how many problems they had with the jury, how many things they just, you know, some of the jurors that they just let slide.
Well, the only jury, this came up in one of the appeals and the court rejected it, but the only juror that was really had any legally problematic things was the woman with the red hair. She lied about being, you know, because one of the questions in the jury selection was, have you ever been involved with any kind of legal proceedings? And she said no, but it turned out that she had had a restraining order, like a domestic violence restraining order against someone. And, you know, they tried to get the conviction overturned because of that, but that didn't work.
Okay.
I mean, just because the jury kind of emerges being like, yeah, you know, we feel good about our conviction, whatever, that in and of itself, that's not a reason to,
yeah,
you know, to overturn anything.
I mean, when I heard that the LA Innocence Project was taking his case, I really, again, I don't know what really happened. I have no idea. But what I've always believed was that he did not get a fair trial. He was convicted. He was convicted before he even stepped into that courtroom. Mm-hmm. And then moving it to San Mateo County, like how is that going to change anything? I mean, it was, I understand why they moved it, but
there was
there's nowhere you were going to go.
California.
Yeah. Or anywhere, but definitely nowhere in California.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole point. Like nothing else, no other alternative theory was investigated. And mm-hmm. one of the things that, you know, that is part of this, the documents that they're seeking is a signed affidavit from, I know a lot of this might seem remote to you, but there's just so many different things. A signed affidavit from a person claiming to have heard a man confess to being part of the burglary that took place that day. And according to the person who signed it, one of the burglars said that the other burglars killed Lacey. Let's see. That says that the confessed burglar said that Lacey had confronted the burglars after having caught them wheeling out a safe. The other burglars then killed Lacey and later dumped her body in the bay after supposedly seeing on the news that Scott had been fishing there. Because he, remember, that came out very early.
Yes, yes.
The day of, he said, I was, you know, it's like, he's like, here, this is my alibi, you know? So yeah, which is weird, because why would you, if you really were there dumping a body, why would you that day go and like say, you know, tell where you were?
Yeah.
You know, so that's.
Some may feel like, hey, he had to be honest. Enough people saw him. There's no way to deny it.
But he didn't know that at the time. You know, I mean, if he hadn't given them that parking pass or the fishing pass or whatever he had. I mean, I don't know. I don't think there was GPS tracking. No one was tracking him. Maybe he could have tracked his cell phone. Probably could have done that. But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, just like who would see you or whatever. The Berkeley Marina is, you know, there's usually lots of people out there. But December 24th, not so many. And I could see how you could get down there, you know, without being seen. But, you know, I also read some things that that a lot of people remembered him talking about playing golf. So that was another thing. Like, why are you telling everyone that you're playing golf, but you really are fishing at the marina?
Well, he said,
then he turned around and said, oh, I was at the marina. So there's a little bit of this, right? Like who's this all has to do with memory, right? We've all realized now that our memories aren't as good as we think they are.
But he told the police, I was planning on golfing, but then it was too cold. So I decided to go fishing, which, okay, some people might think, well, that makes no sense. But to him, it made sense, I guess, if that really was the thought process. And, you know, there's also, you know, I'm not sure if this ever came up in any appeals, but the video that Mark Garagos made,
yes, yes,
tried to recreate, like using the same exact fishing boat with like a 150-pound dummy with anchors, you know, cement anchors tied to it, and tried to show, you know, that it was pretty much impossible to dump a body in the bay without the thing capsizing. That was not let in.
Yes. I remember that from the documentary. That was very compelling. I have to say that was compelling.
Yeah. So, you know, basically there's no witnesses, no murder weapon, no evidence of a struggle.
Cause they found no blood, nothing in the house. Though if you strangle someone, there wouldn't be blood, right? I mean,
well,
he could strangle.
There'd be signs of a struggle, perhaps. I mean,
okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's just that they were just, you know, the police were laser focused on him.
Yeah.
And especially once they found out he was having an affair.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's Scott did everything. I mean, Scott really was, he's a piece of work. That much for sure is that he was, this has been corroborated that he was unfaithful many, right. many times with Lacey.
So the fact that he's having an affair is not unusual.
Yeah, no, because it's not. People
were trying to say that, oh, he met this woman. First of all, he'd only known her a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like they had gone on two dates, apparently. Yes, like,
it's
really.
Not like he's madly in love with her. He's trying, you know, he's just having, like, trying to
having a good
have
time.
Sex with someone besides his wife, right? So this is par for the course, but they tried to make it out like, he was probably always having an affair. It sounds like all,
and that's what's come out
all the time.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh my gosh, I met this woman, I'm madly in love, I've got to get rid of my pregnant wife.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the narrative.
Like, yeah.
That they tried. I mean, there was just no way that this guy could defend himself against, you know, the bias of the police and the court of public opinion and all these jurors who came in. And I'm sorry, that was such a sensationalized case. Everyone knew about it. You'd have to go to Mars to find someone who's never heard of it, who's going to look at it with like no biases at all.
Oh no, and everyone had convicted him. Everyone had convicted him. I mean, they had. I mean, I remember when the verdict came out, being at the dog park and this woman walking in going, they got the bastard, you know, and everyone knew what that meant. And no, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, the guy is a cheater and an arrogant piece of shit. And he did not get a fair trial. Everything else is a big giant question mark. Right.
I don't know how much of a question mark it is. I mean, look, if they get this DNA and the DNA in this van is connected to Lacey.
Yeah. So do you think that's enough for him to be released? Or enough to get a new trial? He wouldn't be released. He would get a new trial. Right. That's what would happen next.
I'm not really sure procedurally at that point.
Okay.
Because a new trial, usually with like, if you have newly discovered evidence that shows you are actually innocent, I think they just release you.
Mm, okay.
You know, I'm appellate law is not my forte, but yeah, why, if something actually exonerates you, like DNA evidence, why would you have to go back and face a trial?
I don't know. I'm asking you. I don't know.
I don't think so. Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, you know, and when you look at a lot of the stuff, I'm going to pull this timeline up. Okay. So, you know, the prosecution made a lot about this, you know, timeline of events, you know, to use it against him. And, you know, they talk about, like, for instance, this is one that just kind of struck me. So he comes back from the marina and the dog is in the yard and with the leash on.
Well, yes.
They're presuming that Scott noticed that the leash was on.
Mm-hmm.
They also said that Lacey's car was in
the driveway.
And
the dog was very muddy. And I think that more than one person found the dog, right? I said more than one person. So I think the dog got loose several times. Just FYI.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Which shows you that no one was there, you know? Anyway.
Well, yeah, because... So where was I?
I'm sorry.
So the car's in the garage or car's in the driveway. They didn't have a garage. Mm-hmm. Car's in the driveway. And what Scott has said was that wasn't alarming to him that the car was in the driveway and she wasn't there because frequently her mom would come and pick her up and they would go do errands or go do stuff. So he just thought that, you know, she was with her mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they say, well, he just came in before he even tried to check on her or anything. He came in and, you know, took a shower. And it was like, well, yeah, he had just been out, like, you know, fishing and whatever. And so he didn't think there was anything unusual about her not being there, because her mom probably could have picked her up. That has happened before.
Well, and also, you know, I've been married a long time. It's like, if you're, you know, when you're an adult and your adult partner isn't there, mm-hmm. even though maybe even though the car is in the driveway or whatever it is, like, I personally wouldn't freak out either, right? I wouldn't start banging on doors. Like, I would give it some time, you know, I would give it a little bit of time to see what would happen. And then a couple hours later, or if I'm texting. So yeah, I agree with you. Like, that's not that crazy to just be like, okay, well, they're somewhere.
Right.
You know, I'll hear soon.
So then he said, okay, so he took a shower, changed his clothes, and then he went into the kitchen, listened to the phone messages, and he listened to a message that, well, first there was messages he left Lacey when he was leaving the marina.
Mm-hmm.
He actually called her a couple of times. And then, let's see, then there was a message from Lacey's stepfather asking if Scott and Lacey could bring whipped cream when they came to the house. So this prompted Scott to call Ron and Sharon's home, since he assumed Lacey was already there. So when Scott asked if Lacey was there, she was not. Then that's when everybody realized that something was wrong. And apparently Sharon asked if the dog was in the yard, and that's when Scott remembered that the leash was on the dog.
Mm.
So I don't know. So, I mean, all these things and all the stuff that he talked about had happened before he left to go fishing. It's all corroborated. Like he said, like there was evidence of computer evidence that at 8:45 a.m., she's looking at like some sunflower umbrellas and stuff that her computer, her login, you know, the Martha Stewart thing that he talked about, that actually was true. She was talking about lemon meringue on that morning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like just, but again, anything that helped Scott in any way was turned against him,
mm-hmm.
or just ignored, or you know, there was some nefarious whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It's just, I think he deserves another look. I think they should look into this, this robbery across the street.
I mean, at least he deserves to at least have the DNA tested. I mean, at the very least. I mean, that to me feels like pretty glaring.
Because this is a circumstantial case, and it's like, unless someone witnessed it or there's some physical evidence tying him to it, how can he be, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Call me stupid, but.
Well, I know. And we got a lot of crap very early on in our podcast because we watched the Casey Anthony documentary, and that maybe she is innocent. Maybe, you know, because she was found innocent, maybe that is true. And listen, this is the thing is that we see this time and time again, which is we see, like we just saw it in that show, in that other documentary that we covered, American Nightmare. And the thing is we saw these police officers, detectives rushing to judgment, rushing to barely giving this guy time to even wrap his brain around what's going on when he gives a statement. I mean, already they're already on him. They're already like,
he's already the suspect.
Yeah. He's already the suspect. And so the thing is that when we talk about American Nightmare and we talk about the rush of judgment of those detectives, because they're innocent people and they, you know, they aren't cheating partners and they're not doing these terrible things that we've deemed terrible, right? We instantly can see how this rush to judgment is bad. And we instantly start to go in and defend the two people in that documentary. And I do feel like Scott Peterson has gotten a pretty raw deal because we just all decided, oh, he's a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a cheater. And listen, none of the things that he did were good. I mean, the cheating and then him telling him, like, I'm a widower. First, I'm single, and then I'm a widower, and I'm this, and then, oh, you know, I'm here.
But cheaters have to lie.
Yes. No, so cheaters have to lie. So saying that you're, yes, saying you're a widower, and I mean, again, and then fleeing and the dyeing the hair and all of it, none of that makes him look very good. But it doesn't change the fact that, you know, there's this rush to judgment. And I think that's the part that's hard, is that in the world that we live in today, especially when, you know, these big cases that are tried in the media, the problem is we are so black and white in our thinking. And if we see someone who's being accused of something and we see them doing things that we deem we don't like or we think are bad, we instantly jump on this bandwagon. But and that's not fair.
The two examples you just gave, him, quote unquote, fleeing and mm-hmm. dyeing his hair. Okay. His explanation for that, he dyed his hair because he was trying to, like, conceal his identity, because
yeah.
he couldn't go anywhere without people yelling, you know, murderer at him.
Mm-hmm.
He was in San Diego, where his parents live.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. San Diego is near the border, but, mm-hmm. but millions of people live in San Diego and are not crossing the Mexican border. His parents lived there.
Yeah.
He's down there visiting his parents. He had his brother's ID, he claimed, to get into this country club because they were going to play golf and he didn't want to pay the fee. You know, he had, that's the thing, for every single thing they.
What about the 50? What was his reason for the $15,000 in cash?
Well, it wasn't $15,000, less than that. And
okay.
His mom testified about this. She said that she gave it to him. It had something to do with the sale of a car. She sold some car that was, they'd bought together, and she just had this cash and she gave it to him. And she testified about this, you know. I mean, you know, again, it's like everything is, when you've already decided that someone is guilty, everything is just, you just use that to corroborate it. And you have to look at these things more critically. Now, also, that I think it's very interesting about the, like, if these burglars really did, you know, see on the news, you know, that he was at the bay and they dumped the body in the bay, that seems totally plausible to me. And also, a couple mm-hmm. of her pregnant women bodies, baby bodies, had washed up around that same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, look, we live here on the bay.
Yeah.
There are so many bodies dumped in
yes.
the bay.
And there are a lot of bodies in the bay.
If you live in Modesto or Sacramento, or if you want to dump a body with mm-hmm. the least amount of possibility of it ever being found, you dump it in the San Francisco Bay. It has very, very strong and violent currents. It's a miracle that those bodies washed up, really. I mean,
yeah. Which then makes it kind of interesting of, like, oh, I wonder if the people that dumped them, right, if they, I don't know, maybe they knew a little bit something about the currents, and maybe they knew that they would be washed up. Who knows? But mm-hmm. the other thing too is, yeah, the currents here, they're so violent. So it's really hard to know where someone dumped, where, you know, from. We're surrounded yeah. by this bay, hence called the Bay Area. We're all around this bay. And so you can dump a body anywhere in the bay and God knows where it's going to end up. Because if anyone knows this area, you know, and I don't know, you've been out on a boat on the bay, right? It is,
yeah,
it is like rocky. It can be crazy. Like one time I was like, I think I'm going to die on this boat. I mean, it was really scary. So anyway,
anyway.
It's very easy to dump a body and
Yeah, we're just trying to look at this through a more critical lens, and just, you know, it's just interesting.
Interesting
to me anyway. I don't know. There are a lot of people who just want to deem him convicted and that's that, because, you know, I don't know. Yeah, a lot of people are very uncomfortable with shades of gray.
Yes.
Not. And again, you know, unless there's a reliable witness or some sort of, this isn't like the OJ case where everybody's DNA is everywhere, all over everything. We're not trying mm-hmm. to defend OJ.
Yeah.
You know, but But this is a case that is kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah. 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 It is. It really, really is. Psych Legal Pop will be back after these messages. Are you feeling lost or uncertain about your future? It's time to discover the true you. This is Tess Brigham from Psych Legal Pop podcast, and I want to tell you about my book, True You. In True You, I delve into the 6 key issues we all face during our quarter life crises. From career dilemmas to relationship struggles, this book provides simple tools and techniques to navigate each challenge. True You is your roadmap to personal growth. Even if you're not experiencing a quarter life crisis, True You will help you get to know yourself on a deeper level. If you're ready to unlock your true potential and create a life you love, pick up your copy of True You today. You can find more information on my website, www.tessbrigham.com, or it's available to purchase at Amazon.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Interesting about the blood on the mattress. I didn't realize that. And I felt like, to me, maybe I'm wrong, but I felt like for the Innocence Project to take on this case, again, right? They have limited time, limited money, limited budget. So I really felt like, and it takes a lot to get a case like this taken on by the Innocence Project. And so I thought, oh, then they really see something that's compelling in there. And if at the very least, even after all of this, let's say we find evidence that it was Scott. Scott did kill Lacey. But that does not negate the fact that people deserve to have fair trials. Mm-hmm. And that was my other thought was that with the Innocence Project, I'm like, I'm wondering if they're taking this on just to basically be able to, you know, we need this. This is important. This is, yeah. Well, and we need some critical, we have to uphold these things. We have to, our entire, everything that we were built on, this foundation was innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. And we've somehow lost that. And I'm not saying I'm innocent of that myself, like that I don't, my mind and these biases, because if you have a brain, you have bias. We all have biases, but it's this collective unwillingness of each person, you know, starting with the detectives and moving out to stop and say, okay, yes, you know, the story doesn't look good, or, you know, he's arrogant, or yeah, he's a serial cheater, or whatever these things are. But at the same time, I cannot convict this, you know, I cannot see this person as guilty until he's convicted of a crime. And unfortunately, in our society, we do the opposite.
Yeah.
Well, and even if you get off, look at Casey Anthony, we still think you're guilty. Right?
I know. When we covered that case, and God, people just came for us.
Yeah, people really came for us.
And, you know,
people are mad. They wrote us emails individually.
Yeah, personal emails.
They found us.
They found me on Instagram.
Yes.
Personal Instagram.
Yeah.
Wrote. And it's just, yeah. Like, look, if you don't want to look things through with a critical eye, this is not the podcast for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not. And again, we're not sitting here saying that he's innocent. We're saying something's not right, that these things were withheld. They weren't investigated yet. Why is it that there's this DNA related to a burglary across the street from their house when there were reports that they knew about that burglary all along? you know, yeah. It happened on Christmas Day. The police knew about it when it happened. And they didn't seem to care if there was a connection or not. And so they just, like, pretended to maybe do something, but didn't.
And this is why this is so important. We have to hold, especially law enforcement, up to these very, very high standards of you check everything out. You check every box. You make sure you have got to, you know, cover all of your bases. You can't just decide, I don't like, you know, this guy seems smarmy, or I don't like the way he's acting, and then just zero in on him. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of times people take this attitude of, well, who cares? He's in the right place, or, you know, he's a jerk, or whatever you want to think. But the thing is that it's important for us to hold ourselves, all of us, to these standards and to these beliefs, because this is how we, you know, this is how our society needs to run. And you want to do this, and you want to take these critical eyes, because you don't know what's going to happen in your life. You don't know what's going to happen to someone that you love. You don't know. And so I would think that you would want to be treated with, you would want the police to investigate everything if this was your brother or husband or whomever this was in your life, right? I mean, you would want the police to do that. And I think that's the part that's really important for people to understand about what we're trying to say, is that it's just about, right, allowing people to have a fair trial, fair shot.
Well, we also, you know, live in this culture where, you know, there's so many shows about crime and law and detectives, and, you know, like, people, you know, they think that everyone thinks that they're,
you know, like an amateur sleuth,
amateur attorney, amateur whatever. You know, people look at these cases and they just, everyone is just has such a strong opinion without really knowing what goes on behind the scenes and in the courtroom, and what, you know, what decisions are being made and what evidence mm-hmm. is being let in and not let in. That has a lot to do with it too. Mm-hmm. You know, like this, in this case, the judge didn't allow that reenactment video, you know, mm-hmm. that could have been a defining thing. Like, what if the jury had been able to see that mm-hmm. and they just all went, oh God, you know, that could have totally tipped the case. And again, it only takes it takes one person to hang a jury. So if even just one person had some doubt, you know, and how many times can you have a hung jury before the prosecution gives up? You know what I mean? They only have so many resources and mm-hmm. whatever. So it could have made a difference. So every little ruling that the judge makes is important. Every piece of evidence that does or does not come in is important. And people don't know all that, or they don't know what actually is going on. And then they make all these proclamations that, you know, oh, it's this and oh, it's that. And, mm-hmm. and
well, and also, I mean, it comes back to this, idea of the media and what's the media's role in all mm-hmm. of this. There was a great documentary that came out a couple years ago about media, tried by media. Mm-hmm. It was on Netflix, and it was about all these big, big cases. I don't know if Scott Peterson was part of it, but big cases that we all know that were essentially tried in the media, that people were talking about ahead of time. And that's the thing. We always hear from these police shows and these police these true crime documentaries about how, you know, we couldn't tell the family anything. We had to keep facts close to our chest. We had to, like, you know, we couldn't release any of these things. We had to keep certain facts aside. And if you look at this case, like, everything came out, that where Scott was that day, you know, should that have been public consumption? You know, should that, because we're now seeing that, could someone have used that against him? The fact that was out there, that information, you know, so there is some piece of this too, of the media and how the media has a responsibility too in all of this. Like, maybe we need to start looking at this and addressing some of these things and asking ourselves these questions of, you know, how much should the media be allowed to report on or not report on, and how much? Because it was in the news every day. Right. Because of this 24-hour news cycle, they just, like, certain cases, you just on and on and on and on and on. And there's Nancy Grace with her very strong opinions about everything, you know. And again, you've got the Nancy Graces of the world. Here's my question.
They're making money off of this.
Yeah. And who is Nancy Grace? Like, is she a former attorney?
She's a former prosecutor.
So, yeah, you wonder about some of these people. It's like, okay, so you're a former prosecutor, like for how long?
But I think she went to law school because her fiance was murdered.
Mm.
Okay, so she went to law school to become a prosecutor, and you know, she had a, you know, close person to her murder. So her bias was always there.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And when you see these people who are reporting, yeah, it's like, well, who are they? What is their background? How much experience do they have? They're also entertainers. You have to get on the TV and you have to have something to say and you have to be interesting. And so trust me, when you start talking about like the finer points of the law and evidence and stuff, people's eyes glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even like just I could tell when I'm talking about some of this stuff, people are probably going, oh, this is so boring. But I try not to be too and give you too much detail. But you have to have some detail to understand.
Yeah.
OK, what's the issue here? But you don't tune into Fox News or CNN or whatever you watch to see some boring analysis of the evidence code. I mean, it's like. It's because it's become entertainment, and then that's how people get their news about the case. And then you have these hysterical people, you know, like Nancy Grace, you know, just going off. She's not the only one, but
she just seems to be the most infamous person. But you're right. Yeah, they have to, because it's a 24-hour news cycle and there's so many channels, they have to entertain. So they have to have strong opinions. And I just get the sense of anytime you say something to the effect of maybe Scott Peterson is innocent, you know, maybe that's possible. It's funny. People get very weird about it. They're like, no, that can't be. And it's like, well,
as if murder,
that like, you know,
right. As if the murder of a woman, pregnant or not, couldn't be random, couldn't be wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
Women disappear every day.
Yes.
Women disappear every day. Nobody knows what happened to them, how they die. Sometimes they find their bodies, sometimes they don't. But if it's a pregnant white lady, you know, we've got to find out, and it's probably her husband. So let's look for every confirmation bias, you know, piece of information we can find. And he's having an affair.
Oh my God. Yeah. And he told his wife, he told her he was a widower and this is going to be his first Christmas without her. And oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, Scott Peterson is a liar.
He's clearly a liar. Big fat liar. For sure.
Not
he's a cheater and he's a liar.
Yeah.
I think that if we're going to go along that he was wrongfully convicted, if you do take a step back from this, like Scott had it kind of made, right? Because he was regularly cheating on Lacey, had been, I think, throughout their entire marriage.
Probably.
And, you know, right? I think for a lot of men who are serial cheaters, that's what they want. They want to remain with their partners because they don't want to pay them and they don't want to have to like uproot their lives and move and disrupt, you know, and they're going to have this baby together. And, you know, it seemed like, why wait until she's almost 8 months pregnant to kill her if you weren't really happy about this, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of like, okay, you know, he seemed to have it all, right? Didn't he? I mean, he's doing everything that he wants to do. Why disrupt that?
He doesn't want to be in a serious relationship with Amber Fry. He's just telling her that. He's love bombing her and telling her stuff so he can sleep with her.
Mm-hmm.
Wake up, people. This is how this is how it works, okay?
Yeah.
This is how men who cheat, this is what they do. Every woman they meet, you know, they do and say what they have to do so that they can get them into bed and then they move on to the next person. I mean, is this, they should have had an expert testify about this.
Yeah.
About this pattern.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, I see. And because they were really leaning into this idea that he was so in love with Amber and this is why he wanted to get rid of his wife.
They're like, he even picked her daughter up from school one day.
It's like, no, he's like, will this get me laid?
Yeah. He's like, he probably told her, oh, I know you're busy. You know, I'll pick her up. Yeah. He's love bombing her.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he wants to go and make a family with her.
Yeah.
He's just doing what he has to do and saying what he has to say. But.
And there have been lots of stories and reports about Scott Peterson about the fact that a lot of people knew he was a well-known womanizer.
Well,
like
her parents knew that he had cheated on Lisa.
Okay. Yeah. So it was like there was Amber Fry. And then I mentioned in my synopsis two other women. But I think there were tons.
Know of. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe that there were lots and lots of women. I think he was constantly always cheating on her. And I think that's the other part of it, too, about this like golfing/, you know, boating thing. I mean, I think Scott was always kind of like, I'll golf, you know, kind of like, oh, maybe I'll, you know, do this, maybe I'll do that. Is Amber around? No. Well, okay. You know, is this what's happening?
Here, I just had a thought. So they, Lacey's parents claim they didn't even know Scott had a boat. Scott bought the boat and didn't tell Lacey because he knew she'd be pissed because it was a several $1,000 boat.
Yeah.
They're about to have a baby. And if he said, I'm going to go buy a boat, she would have been pissed off. So she didn't know about the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So he told, because again, he's a liar. He told her, I'm going to go play golf. And only when he had to use the boating thing as an alibi.
Yeah.
And he was confronted with that. And they said, oh, I thought you were going golfing. And then he had to fess up and say, oh, no, well, it was too cold to go golfing. So I went boating. Here's my receipt. He thought that was his alibi.
Mm-hmm.
Little did he know.
Yeah.
Like they were going to use that as the crux of, you know, what happened. And they just constructed a case from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, you know, Scott did them no favor. Like Scott right into it. Like he really, really did. But again, that's
because
not
a criminal,
his fault.
If you're not a criminal, you're not thinking about. Yeah. He's just like having to answer these questions on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not thinking about any of this. And I'm not trying to sound like I'm defending him. I'm just saying that like, again, these are alternative scenarios that can explain some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Where people go, well, what about this? And what about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, well, we're going to be following this.
Yes. I'm very curious to see what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be if that's her blood, that would be crazy after all of this. I mean, crazy.
Totally crazy.
Crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to take a while. They have some other hearings set up, I think, like in April and May. But this is going to be, this is going to be a long, drawn out thing. But.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any exciting news to report, we'll keep up with it, of course.
I can't believe all of this happened 21, 22 years ago. I mean, it's crazy to think about how long this has been and what's been going on this whole time and all of it.
Yeah. Well, that's what I saw some clips of the hearing in March. You know, it was the very first hearing and he was appearing like by Zoom from wherever he's in prison, somewhere in Central California or something. But he looks very different.
Yeah, he does. I thought he was in San Quentin.
No, he's off death row.
Okay, but I just assumed they would move him from San Quentin's death row to like general population San Quentin.
San Quentin basically consists of death row, and it's actually for people who are there for fairly short.
San Quentin? It is. Interesting. Huh.
So if you're going away for some years, you go to one of many prisons in California that are basically all in the Central Valley.
Yes. You know,
in the hot, dry Central Valley. And
good times.
You go out there to rot, you know. So that's where he is now. But yeah, I mean, so he must be 50.
Yeah, he was born. You share a birthday with him.
Oh, yeah, we have the exact, not the same year.
But not the same year. He's a year older than I am, so he'll be 52 this year.
Yeah, I mean.
So he's 51 right
now. Yeah, so he doesn't have that, like, boyish.
Oh, no, he's not. The boyish look, the collagen has left his face. I mean, I can't imagine, right, those death row prison. I mean, they're in that cell for
23 and a half hours.
Yeah. So, I mean, that will really do something to you. Yeah. That was the whole issue with the West Memphis 3. Damian Nichols. That's one of the things why they took the Alford plea is that because they didn't want to, because they, you know, continue to maintain their innocence. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to say that because they didn't want to say we're guilty at all. But basically, Damien was dying, you know, from just lack of sunlight
and movement.
Yeah, all of those things. Yeah. He was dying. And so they just felt like, yeah, we have to, you know, we have to. What are we going to do? We can't let him die. So
prison is especially if you're on. Were they on death row?
Damien was.
Yeah.
He was convicted. The other two weren't. But I mean, they were all serving. The other two were serving life sentences. And so the other one of them that was in the general population, he was the one that was like, I'm not pleading guilty in any way, shape or form to this because I didn't do this. And it was just like, oh, no, I need to let. Oh, OK. And then they went to him and said, Damien's dying. Mm-hmm. You know, the lack of vitamin D, the lack of all of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine, tiny little cell.
Yeah,
yeah. I used to represent people, inmates at San Quentin who had parole violation hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's
something. Yeah. What's that like going into San Quentin?
Oh, it's scary. I mean, first of all, it's such an old building.
Yeah.
Kind of decrepit. And so at least the place where the hearings were held, you walk in and there's these like hearing rooms off to the right. And then you go down the hallway and the men who are there waiting for their hearings, they have them in cages.
Oh, God.
They're literally like a cage with a bench. You couldn't even stand up in it. And they're handcuffed to the bench or the cage or whatever. And so I have to like stand there kind of crouched over. And
oh good, that's where you have to meet them? Yeah. You don't even get to like, they don't take them up and move them. Oh my
when
God.
When the hearing starts, they do. They take them to the hearing room. But like when I would go to talk to them before the hearing to, you know, go over the report with them and ask them what happened, talk about it, whatever, I was literally, there was nowhere for me to, I didn't have a chair. I was standing up crouching over and then there's all these other inmates in cages watching all of this. There's no privacy. Yeah. So they're just one cage after another. And usually I would just be there for like two hearings. Sometimes they try to do three or four. Yeah. And then they bring them into the room and you do the hearing. It's so like they're trying to pretend like they're giving these people some due process.
Yeah.
But not really. You know, it's just a formality. And, you know,
this is someone who was on parole and they violated their parole. Right. So now they're back and they need you to defend them or to be there as a representative.
Right. Because, and there's already a report from their parole officer saying, okay, this is what they did to violate parole. And this is what we're recommending that they be returned for, you know, 3 months or 6 months or whatever. And so then you have to try to come up with some, you know, mitigating factors or some story, some whatever. And so the client can testify about, you know, well, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they want to, they can have witnesses come in, but nobody ever has witnesses. One time I represented a guy who his fiance came in to testify for him, but you know, that's not very useful. It's very biased or whatever. So it's a formality, but yeah, I mean, just going in there, just the whole, you know, and you just realize that you walk out of there and those guys go back, you know, from their cage back to their cell, you know, and they're going to be there for another, you know, 6 months or so. And then maybe they get paroled again and then whatever.
Because I remember our Uncle Bill, he was teaching a class there.
Well, he was doing tutoring.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Oh, was he tutoring? I thought he was teaching a class in sociology or something. Anyway, so yeah. He was going in once a week for a class or that he was teaching. And he said teaching the class was great, but he said the process of getting in was hell, mm-hmm. right? Like, and the other thing about San Quentin, if you're not from out here, is like, it's in Marin County, which is the, you know, this is where Tiburon, you know, yeah, where Sean Penn lives, yeah. Like very, very wealthy area, very, very wealthy. One of the wealthiest county around here. I mean, it's always has been, I think now probably Silicon Valley's more higher, but it's of this very wealthy place and it's right there on the water. I mean, it's beautiful views. And if you drove by and you didn't know what it was, and if it didn't have the signage, you wouldn't really know what it is, mm-hmm. right? If the signs didn't exist, it doesn't look like a prison.
No.
And it's so funny because every time I go into Marin, you pass it and it's just this weird thing of like last exit for San Quentin, you know, and then you kind of make this turn and then all of a sudden you're in Larkspur, you know, in this beautiful, beautiful like boats, all these boats that people have in this beautiful area. But I'm curious about, right, that you said that there were, how hard was it to just like navigate in getting into the prison? Like you're not being strip searched. I figured that much, but no. Like, what do you have to wear? And like, are you like, how much security do you have to go through? And
oh, you go through, even the attorneys, they go through the full security. They basically tell you ahead of time. They give you some tips. They're like, don't wear a bra that has underwire in it.
Uh-huh.
You know, belts. You know, they're like, you know, don't wear, you know, you try to be as minimalistic as possible. And there are only certain things you can bring in. I mean, this was kind of before everyone had cell phones and gadgets mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, you're supposed to leave that stuff in the car. You know, mm-hmm. you basically just come in like with your basic clothes on, you know, no metal, no jewelry. And then, you know, you're file and your notepad and your pen, and that's mm-hmm. about all they will let you bring in.
And so, and what's the you know, being a female in that environment, so are the men looking at you? Do you feel unsafe at any point? Are they, I mean, I would assume they can't really be catcalling you or anything, they'd be in trouble, but
nobody at San Quentin ever catcalled me. I'd been in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Places. I mean, San Quentin's pretty scary. Like, it's pretty intimidating. I mean, first of all, these guys are in cages, so I'm not like afraid they're going to attack me or anything.
No, but I'm just wondering if you're trying to bend over and talk to this person, if there's some guy like, hey, check her out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And San Quentin wasn't too bad, but I had been in places that were more, you know, lesser security, where it's kind of more open.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's guys kind of roaming around and, you know, the security's not, and yeah, they'll like come over and try to talk to you. And, mm-hmm. You know, they always want to talk to you about their case. And
oh
you,
God.
Like,
you'd
be sitting there waiting for your client to be brought in. And oh my gosh, I remember the very first time I went into a jail. So when I was in law school, I did an internship at the public defender's office, and the jail, the city, San Francisco city jail, is like right across the street. And so the public defender I worked for would ask me to go over there and just kind of talk to some of these guys. Because, you know, they're always calling, being like, I want to talk to you. I need to talk mm-hmm. to you. And she didn't have time. So she's like, will you go over there and talk to so-and-so and just talk to so-and-so. And that I was like propositioned all the time. Like, I'd be sitting mm-hmm. there waiting for my client, and there'd be some inmate out in the hallway, you know, mopping the floor because, you know, he's got special privileges or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. he's on good behavior, and told me he was getting out next week and wanted to know if I wanted to go out on a date.
Well, you know, because I worked for Brooke when I was in law school, when I was getting my master's, my counseling psychology master's, whatever it was called, you know, I can't think of it right now, to become a therapist. I worked for Brooke part-time. And I remember, because I had to, you know, I would go through your files and I would read sometimes, I would see these letters. I remember there were a few letters. It was the funniest thing. There were some that were like,
the dear attorney,
yes, yeah. Dear attorney Brigham, and, you know, hi. And there was a guy in there, different guy, I'm sure, different guy that was like, hey, you know, I'm getting like one of these things, like I'm getting out in a few weeks, wondering if you're free. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But, But would you wear like minimal? Because I would be very conscious of like wearing, you know, again, me at 50, it's very different. I think no one looks at 50-year-old women anymore. So, I mean, I think it'd be different if I was much younger. But like, would you wear minimal? But you were younger then. So it's yeah, like, would 30, you wear? Yeah.
28,
so
30.
Would you wear minimal makeup? Or I mean, try to like put your hair back? Would you try to look kind of ugly and kind of like homely? No. So you're like, no one can.
No, I would just, I would do my hair and makeup. However, I don't wear a lot of makeup and, you know, my hair is, I would just do my normal hair. But yeah, I would not wear anything that was at all low cut. I usually wear pants, you know, not a skirt.
Yeah, I would definitely wear pants.
Yeah. No, I, and in general, the way I dressed, you know, yeah, your lawyers' outfits are not very sexy. It's not like suits or, you know, TV shows where people are like in the tight pencil skirts and plunging low, you know, crisp white shirts. That's just not how lawyers dress in real life. So, yeah, you want to be comfortable and, yeah, you don't want to be, you don't want to draw any attention to yourself. And so that's how I would pretty normally dress. So I wouldn't really change what I was doing.
But I do remember you had when you first started, when you were, because the first part of your career was in criminal law. I remember you talking about your prison bra. Like you had a one bra.
Yeah, no underwire.
No, because you need, right? And back then, because again, this was 25 years ago, right? So what people don't recognize is that, right, there was either like, wired bras or sports bra. There really wasn't a lot of options out there. And the idea of like, I have to wear an underwire bra, like I need support. So the idea of like not wearing a bra in a prison seems like a recipe for disaster.
I'd wear like, you know, some kind of sports bra or something. And I mean, I'm sure I was being more modest than if I was going somewhere else, but yeah, it's tricky. I mean, you know.
And so what do you say when he says, you know, I'm getting out in a week or so? Are you just like,
I just kind of ignore it, you know, just kind of like, oh, okay, that's nice. You know, I mean, I'm not going to engage it, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to like give it some excuse why I can't. No, I'm busy. I'm washing my hair that night. Just try not to engage. Try not to engage, but. It is weird being a woman in that space. And most of the women who were like, you know, very successful criminal defense attorneys were very masculine, you know, and a lot of them were lesbians, you know, who were very masculine presenting. They were the most successful criminal defense lawyers, better than the men, you know.
Yeah.
And you kind of, and that's just kind of how you have to be. And I don't, you know, and so that's not really me. And, you know, I enjoyed doing it while I did it. And I was a true believer. I really did believe in helping people and whatnot, but I was just like, I can't do this long term.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's, you know, some of those careers, right? Like either you do it for a period of time and then you got to get out, or there are some people that are, you know, lifers that really can handle it. But I think it just takes a certain personality and you have to have certain situations in your life, you know, where it just makes it easy for you to keep going. And it is funny how people are about this kind of stuff. It's like everyone deserves representation. You know, they do, of course, of course they deserve, you know, no matter what you believe or not, it's like, of course, someone deserves someone to be competent to go in there and defend them. And I think that's the part that is just crappy about the whole situation is I wish there were a lot more people out there and a lot more lawyers out there, you know, that could defend these people, because this is a big issue. This is a systemic issue is that the majority of the people don't, you know, they don't have any money. And so they're not getting a great defense.
Yeah.
And then we got this rush to judgment and all these other kinds of things.
Yeah.
So.
Although I have to say that, you know, public defenders always get a bad rap. They're some of the best lawyers out there because, you know, they're doing this day in and day out. They are in an office with very experienced people. So they get trained by very experienced people. And, you know, this idea that somehow that's a, you know, inferior lawyer, not at all. Not at all.
So where does that narrative come from? Is that from just like movies and TV reinforcing that?
Yeah.
Like, because that is a narrative in a lot of shows.
Yeah. It's a narrative. Yeah. Like the public defender is just this bumbling idiot. And so then you have to hire this high priced.
Yeah. You know, or someone's like, I'm innocent of my crime and I got convicted because I had a crappy public defender. That's always like a story. Yeah, and anytime you see that, you blame it on the public defender. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think as an attorney, probably, right, the two best places to be would be the prosecutor's office and the public defender. That's where you would learn so much. Mm-hmm. Seems like it's boot camp, right?
Yeah, it is.
For trial experience.
It is boot camp. Totally. And, you know, you could take, even though it's criminal, you could take that experience and you could, you know, turn it into a civil practice. It's just, yeah, that being able to go into court, be comfortable and deal with trials and all you have to do and the rules of evidence and all that kind of stuff. It's great training ground. They're very good lawyers. So that is just a bunch of BS about how somehow that's inferior defense. Although, because usually when they talk about, oh, people were able to hire private attorney and that was better, you know, like the dream team or whatever. Mm-hmm. The difference is the number of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So like the public defender, okay, the state or the federal government has unlimited resources, right?
Mm-hmm.
The public defender's office does not. So you could have a really good public defender, but, and maybe they might have an assistant, you know, if it's like a murder trial or something, but you know, OJ was able to hire like 10 lawyers to defend him on different issues. You know, one was, you know, the DNA lawyer, and then you had the appellate lawyer, and then you had like the trial lawyer, and then you had this, you know what I mean? So that's the difference, is that, you know, you can hire a whole bunch of lawyers.
So how is it that the prosecutor's office have unlimited funds, but if the flip side is the public defender's office, shouldn't they in turn have unlimited funds too?
Well, it's not so much
in theory.
It's not so much unlimited funds. It's that, so the prosecutors have the law enforcement, you know, they're working alongside law enforcement. So you have the resources of the whatever jurisdiction of law enforcement you're working with and all of their detectives and all of their personnel. And you know, I mean, I don't know how the budgets of these offices work, but I'm pretty sure that the budgets in the DA's office are better or the prosecutor's office are better. And they can hire maybe, you know, better experts, especially if it's a federal case, you have the FBI, like, I mean, you know, you have the backing of those agencies.
Yeah.
So it's, that's where it's uneven.
Mm-hmm.
Not like the quality of the lawyering.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like then, okay. So then it sounds like there has to be something where the public defender's office needs more of a budget for investigation.
Yeah.
And they too need a team of people that can help them investigate the other side.
And they do, but it's just always been my perception that, and I think, you know, that it's just a perception in the legal field. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, the unbalanced.
Yeah.
But like I said, I don't know. I don't know.
All right.
Are.
Well,
anyway,
fighting the good fight out there.
Yeah.
All right.
Well,
we should wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up. Yeah. Okay. So again, we mentioned at the top of the show, we have a Patreon now. Go check that out if you're interested in more content. We are going to do a true crime once a month. We're going to do a true crime episode.
Yeah.
You know, so if you enjoy this, you would enjoy that, you know, talking about.
Well, and we also on our Patreon, we are answering questions. Our Patreon members, they get to ask us questions about law issues. So if you are fascinated by this stuff or you have questions or you have an issue that you need to talk about, whether it's mental health or legal, we're here and we'll answer them to the best of our ability.
Yeah. So send us a message on Patreon if you have a question, because we're going to be
We need to start gathering those together soon.
We need questions, so we're soliciting questions. And then every week you get a bonus episode where we just talk about whatever we feel.
Yeah.
Like. And also you can support our podcast by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star rating. That would help us a lot. And I think that's, we're on social media.
Yeah.
Psych Legal Pop on Instagram and TikTok. So I think that's it. Thanks.
Yeah.
If you're still here, thanks.
If you made it through the legal procedure talk.
To our stroll.
Legal talk.
My stroll down memory lane.
But I find this stuff fascinating. I mean, because I don't think that many people walk into a major prison.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many people have the opportunity, you know, to really view it and see it? And anyway, I find it fascinating. Anyway.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.